one little bit. They were not surprised until they got up to their hotel room, and Polly was nowhere to be seen. 4. 1984, mused Amy Pond. I thought somehow it would feel more, I don't know, historical. It doesn't feel like a long time ago, but my parents hadn't even met yet. She hesitated, as if she were about to say something about her parents. But her attention drifted. They crossed the road. "What were they like?" asked the doctor. "Your parents." Amy shrugged. "The usual," she said without thinking. "A mum and a dad." "Sounds likely," agreed the doctor much too readily. "So, I need you to keep your eyes open." "What are we looking for?" It was a little English town, and it looked like a little English town as far as Amy was concerned, just like the one she'd left, only without the coffee shops or the mobile phone shops. "Easy. We're looking for something that shouldn't be here, or we're looking for something that should be here but isn't." "What kind of thing?" "Not sure," said the doctor. He rubbed his chin. "Gazpacho, maybe." "What's gazpacho?" "Cold soup, but it's meant to be cold. So if we looked all over 1984 and couldn't find any gazpacho, that would be a clue." "Were you always like this?"
"Like what?"
"A madman with a time machine?" "Oh, no. It took ages until I got the time machine." They walked through the center of the little town, looking for something unusual, and finding nothing. Not even gazpacho. Polly stopped at the garden gate in Claversham Row, looking up at the house that had been her house since they'd moved here when she was 7. She walked up to the front door, rang the doorbell and waited, and was relieved when nobody answered it. She glanced down the street, then walked hurriedly around the house past the rubbish bins, into the back garden. The French window that opened onto the little back garden had a catch that didn't fasten properly. Polly thought it extremely unlikely that the house's new owners had fixed it. If they had, she'd come back when they were here, and she'd have to ask, and it would be awkward and embarrassing. That was the trouble with hiding things. Sometimes, if you were in a hurry, you left them behind, even important things. And there was nothing more important than her diary. Polly had been keeping it since they had arrived in the town. It had been her best friend. She had confided in it, told it about the girls who had bullied her, the ones who befriended her, about the first boy she had ever liked. It was, sometimes, her best friend. She would turn to it in times of trouble or turmoil and pain. It was the place she poured out her thoughts. And it was hidden underneath a loose floorboard in the big cupboard in her bedroom. Polly tapped the left French door hard with the palm of her hand, rapping it next to the casement, and the door wobbled and then swung open. She walked inside. She was surprised to see that they hadn't replaced any of the furniture her family had taken away. It still smelled like her house. It was silent. Nobody home. Good. She hurried up the stairs, worried she might still be at home when Mr. Rabbit or Mrs. Cat returned. She went up the stairs. On the landing, something brushed her face, touched it gently, like a thread or a cobweb. She looked up. That was odd. The ceiling seemed furry. Hair-like threads or thread-like hairs came down from it. She hesitated then, thought about running, but she could see her bedroom door. The Duran Duran poster was still on it. Why hadn't they taken it down? Trying not to look up at the hairy ceiling, she pushed open her bedroom door. The room was different. There was no furniture, and where her bed had been were sheets of paper. She glanced down, photographs from newspapers blown up to life size. The eye holes had been cut out already. She recognized Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Pope John Paul, the Queen. Perhaps they were going to have a party. The masks didn't look very convincing. She went to the built-in cupboard at the end of the room. Her smash hits diary was sitting in the darkness, beneath the floorboard, in there. She opened the cupboard door.
"Hello, Polly," said the man in the cupboard.
He wore a mask, like the others had, an animal mask. This was some kind of big grey dog. "Hello," said Polly. She didn't know what else to say. I left my diary behind."
"I know. I was reading it."
He raised the diary. He was not the same as the man in the rabbit mask, the woman in the cat mask, but everything Polly had felt about them, about the wrongness, was intensified here.
"Do you want it back?"
"Yes, please," Polly said to the dog-masked man. She felt hurt and violated. This man had been reading her diary, but she wanted it back.
"Do you know what you need to do to get it?"
She shook her head.
"Ask me what the time is."
She opened her mouth. It was dry. She licked her lips and muttered, "What time is it?"
"And my name," he said. "Say my name. I'm Mr. Wolf."
"What's the time, Mr. Wolf?" asked Polly. A playground game rose unbidden to her mind. Mr. Wolf smiled. But how can a mask smile? And he opened his mouth so wide to show row upon row of sharp, sharp teeth.
"Dinner time," he told her.
Polly started to scream then, as he came towards her. But she didn't get to scream for very long. 5. The TARDIS was sitting in a small grassy area, too small to be a park, too irregular to be a square, in the middle of the town, and the doctor was sitting outside it, in a deck chair, walking through his memories. The doctor had a remarkable memory. The problem was, there was so much of it. He had lived 11 lives, or more. There was another life, was there not, that he tried his best never to think about. And he had a different way of remembering things in each life. The worst part of being however old he was, and he had long since abandoned trying to keep track of it in any way that mattered to anybody but him, was that sometimes things didn't arrive in his head quite when they were meant to. Masks. That was part of it. And kin. That was part of it too. And time. It was all about time. Yes, that was it. An old story. Before his time, he was sure of that. It was something he had heard as a boy. He tried to remember the stories he had been told as a small boy on Gallifrey before he had been taken to the Time Lord Academy, and his life had changed forever. Amy was coming back from a sortie through the town.
"Maximilos and the 3 Ogrons," he shouted at her.
"What about them?"
"One was too vicious, one was too stupid, one was just right."
"And this is relevant how?" He tugged at his hair absently.
Probably not relevant at all. Just trying to remember a story from my childhood."
"Why?"
"No idea. Can't remember."
"You," said Amy Pond, "are very frustrating."
"Yes," said the doctor happily. "I probably am."
He had hung a sign on the front of the TARDIS. It said,
"Something mysteriously wrong? Just knock. No problem too small. If it won't come to us, I'll go to it. No, scrap that, other way round. And I've redecorated inside so as not to startle people. What did you find?"
"2 things," she said. "First one was Prince Charles. I saw him in the newsagents."
"Are you sure it was him?"
Amy thought.
"Well, he looked like Prince Charles, just much younger. And the newsagent asked him if he'd picked out a name for the next royal baby. I suggested Rory."
"Prince Charles in the newsagents. Right. Next thing?
There aren't any houses for sale. I've walked every street in the town. No for sale signs.
There are people camping in tents on the edge of town. Lots of people leaving to find places to live because there's nothing around here. It's just weird.
Yes. He almost had it now. Amy opened the TARDIS door. She looked inside.
Doctor!
It's the same size on the inside.
He beamed and took her on an extensive tour of his new office, which consisted of standing inside the doorway and making a waving gesture with his right arm. Most of the space was taken up with a desk, with an old-fashioned telephone and a typewriter on it. There was a back wall. Amy experimentally pushed her hands through the wall. It was hard to do with her eyes open, easy when she closed them. Then she closed her eyes and pushed her head through the wall. Now she could see the TARDIS control room, all copper and glass. She took a step backwards into the tiny office.
Is it a hologram?
Sort of.
There was a hesitant rap at the door of the TARDIS. The doctor opened it.
Excuse me, the sign on the door?
The man appeared harassed. His hair was thinning. He looked at the tiny room, mostly filled by a desk, and he made no move to come inside.
Yes, hello, come in, said the doctor. No problem too small.
My name's Reg Browning. It's my daughter, Polly. She was meant to be waiting for us back in the hotel room. She's not there.
I'm the doctor. This is Amy. Have you spoken to the police?
Aren't you police? I thought perhaps you were.
Why?
Asked Amy. This is a police call box. I didn't even know they were bringing them back.
For some of us, said the tall young man with the bow tie, they never went away.
What happened when you spoke to the police?
They said they'd keep an eye out for her, but honestly, they seemed a bit preoccupied. The desk sergeant said the lease had run out on the police station, rather unexpectedly, and they're looking for somewhere to go. The desk sergeant said the whole lease thing came as a bit of a blow to them.
What's Polly like? Asked Amy. Could she be staying with friends?
I've checked with her friends. Nobody's seen her. We're living in the Rose Hotel on Widnersbury Street, right now.
Are you visiting?
Mr. Browning told them about the man in the rabbit mask who had come to the door last week to buy their house for so much more than it was worth and paid cash. He told them about the woman in the cat mask who had taken possession of the house.
Oh, right. Well, that makes sense of everything, said the doctor, as if it actually did.
It does? Said Mr. Browning. Do you know where Polly is?
The doctor shook his head.
Mr. Browning, Reg, is there any chance she might have gone back to your house?
The man shrugged. Might have done, do you think?
But the tall young man and the red-haired Scottish girl pushed past him, slammed the door of their police box, and sprinted away across the green.
6.
Amy kept pace with the doctor and panted out questions as they ran.
You think she's in the house?
I'm afraid she is. Yes, I've got a sort of an idea.
Look, Amy, don't let anyone persuade you to ask them the time. And if they do, don't answer them. Safer that way.
You mean it?
I'm afraid so. And watch out for masks!
Right, so these are dangerous aliens we're dealing with. They wear masks and ask you what time it is.
It sounds like them, yes, but my people dealt with them so long ago. It's almost inconceivable.
They stopped running as they reached Claversham Row.
And if it is who I think it is, what I think it, they, it, are, well, there's only one sensible thing we should be doing.
What's that?
Running away, said the doctor, as he rang the doorbell.
A moment's silence. Then the door opened and a girl looked up at them. She could not have been more than 11, and her hair was in pigtails.
Hello, she said. My name is Polly Browning. What's your names?
Polly, said Amy. Your parents are worried sick about you.
I just came to get my diary back, said the girl. It was under a loose floorboard in my old bedroom.
Your parents have been looking for you all day, said Amy.
She wondered why the doctor didn't say anything.
The little girl, Polly, looked at her wristwatch.
That's weird. It says I've only been here for 5 minutes. I got here at 10 this morning.
Amy knew it was somewhere late in the afternoon. She said, "What time is it now?" Polly looked up, delighted. This time Amy thought there was something strange about the girl's face. Something flat. Something almost mask-like. "Time for you to come into my house," said the girl. Amy blinked. It seemed to her that, without having moved, she and the doctor were now standing in the entry hall. The girl was standing on the stairs facing them. Her face was level with theirs.
"What are you?"
asked Amy. "We are the kin," said the girl, who was not a girl. Her voice was deeper, darker, and more guttural. She seemed to Amy like something crouching, something huge that wore a paper mask with the face of a girl crudely scrawled on it. Amy could not understand how she could ever have been fooled into thinking it was a real face.
"I've heard of you," said the doctor. "My people thought you were..."
"An abomination," said the crouching thing with the paper mask. "And a violation of all the laws of time. They sectioned us off from the rest of creation. But I escaped, and thus we escaped, and we are ready to begin again. Already we have started to purchase this world."
"You're recycling money through time," said the doctor, "buying up this world with it, starting with this house, the town."
"Doctor, what's going on?" asked Amy. "Can you explain any of this?"
"All of it," said the doctor. "Sort of wish I couldn't.
They've come here to take over the Earth. They're going to become the population of the planet."
"Oh, no, Doctor," said the huge, crouching creature in the paper mask.
"You don't understand. That's not why we take over the planet. We will take over the world and let humanity become extinct simply in order to get you here now."
The doctor grabbed Amy's hand and shouted, "Run!" He headed for the front door and found himself at the top of the stairs. He called, "Amy!" But there was no reply. Something brushed his face, something that felt almost like fur. He swatted it away. There was one door open, and he walked towards it.
"Hello,"
said the person in the room in a breathy female voice.
"So glad you could come, Doctor."
It was Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
"You do know who we are, dear," she asked. "It would be such a shame if you didn't."
"The kin," said the doctor, "a population that only consists of one creature, but able to move through time as easily and instinctively as a human can cross the road. There was only one of you, but you'd populate a place by moving backwards and forwards in time until there were hundreds of you, then thousands and millions, all interacting with yourselves at different moments in your timeline, and this would go on until the local structure of time would collapse like rotten wood. You need other entities, at least in the beginning, to ask you the time and create the quantum superpositioning that allows you to anchor to a place-time location."
"Very good," said Mrs. Thatcher. "Do you know what the Time Lords said when they engulfed our world? They said that as each of us was the kin at a different moment in time, to kill any one of us was to commit an act of genocide against our whole species. You cannot kill me, because to kill me is to kill all of us."
"You know I'm the last Time Lord?"
"Oh, yes, dear."
"Let's see, you pick up the money from the mint as it's being printed, buy things with it, return it moments later, recycle it through time, and the masks, I suppose they amplify the conviction field. People are going to be much more willing to sell things when they believe that the leader of their country is asking for them personally, and eventually you've sold the whole place to yourselves. Will you kill the humans?"
"No need, dear. We'll even make reservations for them, Greenland, Siberia, Antarctica, but they will die out nonetheless. Several billion people living in places that can barely support a few thousand. Well, dear, it won't be pretty."
Mrs. Thatcher moved. The doctor concentrated on seeing her as she was. He closed his eyes, opened them to see a bulky figure wearing a crude black-and-white face mask with a photograph of Margaret Thatcher on it. The doctor reached out his hand and pulled off the mask from the kin. The doctor could see beauty where humans could not. He took joy in all creatures. But the face of the kin was hard to appreciate. You revolt yourself, said the doctor. Blimey, it's why you wear masks. You don't like your face, do you? The kin said nothing. Its face, if that was its face, writhed and squirmed. Where's Amy? Asked the doctor. Surplus to requirements, said another similar voice from behind him, a thin man in a rabbit mask. We let her go. We only needed you, Doctor. Our Time Lord prison was a torment because we were trapped in it and reduced to one of us. You are also only one of you, and you will stay here in this house forever. The doctor walked from room to room, examining his surroundings with care. The walls of the house were soft and covered with a light layer of fur, and they moved gently in and out, as if they were breathing. It's a living room, literally, he said. Give me Amy back. Leave this place. I'll find you somewhere you can go. You can't just keep looping and re-looping through time over and over, though. It messes everything up. And when it does, we begin again, somewhere else, said the woman in the cat mask on the stairs. You will be imprisoned until your life is done. Age here, regenerate here, die here, over and over. Our prison will not end until the last Time Lord is no more. Do you really think you can hold me that easily? The doctor asked. It was always good to seem in control, no matter how much he was worried that he was going to be stuck here for good. Quickly, doctor, down here! It was Amy's voice. He took the steps three at a time, heading towards the place her voice had come from, the front door. Doctor! I'm here. He rattled the door. It was locked. He pulled out his screwdriver and sonicked the door handle. There was a clunk, and the door flew open. The sudden daylight was blinding. The doctor saw, with delight, his friend, and a familiar big blue police box. He was not certain which to hug first. Why didn't you go inside? He asked Amy as he opened the TARDIS door. Can't find the key. Must have dropped it while they were chasing me. Where are we going now? Somewhere safe. Well, safer. He closed the door. Got any suggestions? Amy stopped at the bottom of the control room stairs and looked around at the gleaming, coppery world, at the glass pillar that ran through the TARDIS controls, at the doors. Amazing, isn't she? Said the doctor. I never get tired of looking at the old girl. Yes, the old girl, said Amy. I think we should go to the very dawn of time, doctor, as early as we can go. They won't be able to find us there, and we can work out what to do next. She was looking over the doctor's shoulder at the console, watching his hands move as if she was determined not to forget anything he did. The TARDIS was no longer in 1984. The dawn of time. Very clever, Amy Pond. That's somewhere we've never gone before. Somewhere we shouldn't be able to go. It's a good thing I've got this. He held up the squiggly Watsit, then attached it to the TARDIS console using alligator clips and what looked like a piece of string. There, he said proudly. Look at that. Yes, said Amy. We've escaped the kin's trap. The TARDIS engines began to groan, and the whole room began to judder and shake. What's that noise? We're heading for somewhere the TARDIS isn't designed to go, somewhere I wouldn't dare go without the squiggly Watsit giving us a boost and a time bubble. The noise is the engines complaining. It's like going up a steep hill in an old car. It may take us a few more minutes to get there. Still, you'll like it when we arrive. The dawn of time. Excellent suggestion. I'm sure I will like it, said Amy with a smile. It must have felt so good to escape the kin's prison, doctor. That's the funny thing, said the doctor. You ask me about escaping the kin's prison, that house. And I mean, I did escape just by sonicking a doorknob, which was a bit convenient. But what if the trap wasn't the house? What if the kin didn't want a Time Lord to torture and kill? What if they wanted something much more important? What if they wanted a TARDIS?
Why would the kin want a TARDIS?
Asked Amy. The Doctor looked at Amy. He looked at her with clear eyes, unclouded by hate or by illusion.
The kin can't travel very far through time, not easily, and doing what they do is slow, and it takes an effort. The kin would have to travel back and forward in time 15 million times just to populate London.
What if the kin had all of time and space to move through? What if it went back to the very beginning of the universe and began its existence there? It would be able to populate everything. There would be no intelligent beings in the whole of the space-time continuum that wasn't the kin. One entity would fill the universe, leaving no room for anything else. Can you imagine it?
Amy licked her lips.
Yes, she said. Yes, I can.
All you'd need would be to get into a TARDIS and have a Time Lord at the controls, and the universe would be your playground.
Oh, yes, said Amy, and she was smiling broadly now.
It will be.
We're almost there, said the Doctor. The dawn of time. Please tell me that Amy's safe wherever she is.
Why ever would I tell you that?
Asked the kin in the Amy Pond mask.
It's not true.
7. Amy could hear the Doctor running down the stairs. She heard a voice that sounded strangely familiar calling to him, and then she heard a sound that filled her chest with despair, the diminishing warp, warp of a TARDIS as it leaves. The door opened at that moment, and she walked out into the downstairs hall.
"He's run out on you," said a deep voice. "How does it feel to be abandoned?"
"The Doctor doesn't abandon his friends," said Amy to the thing in the shadows.
"He does. He obviously did in this case. You can wait as long as you want to. He'll never come back,"
said the thing as it stepped out of the darkness and into the half-light. It was huge. Its shape was humanoid, but also somehow animal. Lupine, thought Amy Pond, as she took a step backwards, away from the thing. It had a mask on, an unconvincing wooden mask that seemed like it was meant to represent an angry dog, or perhaps a wolf.
"He's taking someone he believes to be you for a ride in the TARDIS, and in a few moments, reality is going to rewrite. The Time Lords reduced the kin to one lonely entity cut off from the rest of creation, so it is fitting that a Time Lord restores us to our rightful place in the order of things. All other things will serve me, or will be me, or will be food for me. Ask me what time it is, Amy Pond."
Why? There were more of them now. Shadowy figures. A cat-faced woman on the stairs. A small girl in the corner. The rabbit-headed man standing behind her said, "Because it will be a clean way to die. An easy way to go. In a few moments, you will never have existed anyway."
"Ask me," said the wolf-masked figure in front of her. "Say, what's the time, Mr. Wolf?"
In reply, Amy Pond reached up and pulled the wolf mask from the face of the huge thing, and she saw the kin. Human eyes were not meant to look at the kin. The crawling, squirming, wriggling mess that was the face of the kin was a frightful thing. The masks had been as much for its own protection as for everyone else's. Amy Pond stared at the face of the kin. She said, "Kill me if you're going to kill me, but I don't believe that the Doctor has abandoned me, and I'm not going to ask you what time it is."
"Pity,"
said the kin, through a face that was a nightmare. And it moved toward her. The TARDIS engines groaned once, loudly, and then were silent.
"We are here," said the kin.
Its Amy Pond mask was now just a flat, scrawled drawing of a girl's face.
"We're here at the beginning of it all," said the Doctor, "because that's where you want to be. But I'm prepared to do this another way. I could find a solution for you, for all of you."
"Open the door," grunted the kin.
The doctor opened the door. The winds that swirled about the TARDIS pushed the doctor backward. The kin stood at the door of the TARDIS.
It's so dark.
We're at the very start of it all, before light.
I will walk into the void, said the kin, and you will ask me, what time is it? And I will tell myself, tell you, tell all creation. Time for the kin to rule, to occupy, to invade. Time for the universe to become only me and mine and whatever I keep to devour. Time for the first and final reign of the kin, world without end, through all of time.
I wouldn't do it, said the doctor. If I were you, you can still change your mind. The kin dropped the Amy Pond mask onto the TARDIS floor. It pushed itself out of the TARDIS door, into the void.
Doctor!
It called. Its face was a writhing mass of maggots.
Ask me what time it is.
I can do better than that, said the doctor. I can tell you exactly what time it is. It's no time. It's nothing o'clock. It's a microsecond before the Big Bang. We're not at the dawn of time. We're before the dawn. The Time Lords really didn't like genocide. I'm not too keen on it myself. It's the potential you're killing off. What if one day there was a good Dalek? What if... He paused. Space is big. Time is bigger. I would have helped you to find a place your people could have lived. But there was a girl called Polly, and she left her diary behind, and you killed her. That was a mistake.
You never even knew her,
called the kin from the void.
She was a kid, said the doctor. Pure potential, like every kid everywhere. I know all I need.
The squiggly what's-it attached to the TARDIS console was beginning to smoke and spark.
You're out of time. Literally, because time doesn't start until the Big Bang, and if any part of a creature that inhabits time gets removed from time, well, you're removing yourself from the whole picture.
The kin understood. It understood that at that moment, all of time and space was one tiny particle, smaller than an atom, and that until a microsecond passed and the particle exploded, nothing would happen. Nothing could happen. And the kin was on the wrong side of the microsecond. Cut off from time, all the other parts of the kin were ceasing to be. The it that was they felt the wash of non-existence sweeping over them. In the beginning, before the beginning, was the word. And the word was,
Doctor!
But the door had been closed, and the TARDIS vanished. Implacably. The kin was left alone, in the void before creation, alone, forever, in that moment, waiting for time to begin. 8. The young man in the tweed jacket walked around the house at the end of Clavisham Row. He knocked at the door, but no one answered. He went back into the blue box and fiddled with the tiniest of controls. It was always easier to travel 1,000 years than it was to travel 24 hours. He tried again. He could feel the threads of time raveling and re-raveling. Time is complex. Not everything that has happened, after all. Only the Time Lords understood it, and even they found it impossible to describe. The house in Clavisham Row had a grimy, for sale sign in the garden. He knocked at the door.
Hello, he said. You must be Polly. I'm looking for Amy Pond.
The girl's hair was in pigtails. She looked up at the doctor suspiciously. How do you know my name? She asked.
I'm very clever, said the doctor seriously.
Polly shrugged. She went back into the house, and the doctor followed. There was, he was relieved to notice, no fur on the walls. Amy was in the kitchen, drinking tea with Mrs. Browning. Radio 4 was playing in the background. Mrs. Browning was telling Amy about her job as a nurse and the hours she had to work, and Amy was saying that her fiancé was a nurse and she knew all about it. She looked up sharply when the doctor came in, a look as if to say, "You've got a lot of explaining to do."
"I thought you'd be here," said the doctor, "if I just kept looking."
They left the house on Claversham Row. The blue police box was parked at the end of the road, beneath some chestnut trees.
"One moment," said Amy. "I was about to be eaten by that creature. The next, I was sitting in the kitchen, talking to Mrs. Browning and listening to the Archers." "How did you do that?"
"I'm very clever," said the doctor. It was a good line, and he was determined to use it as much as possible.
"Let's go home," said Amy. "Will Rory be there this time?"
"Everybody in the world will be there," said the doctor.
"Even Rory."
They went into the TARDIS. He had already removed the blackened remains of the squiggly Watsit from the console. The TARDIS would not again be able to reach the moment before time began. But then, all things considered, that had to be a good thing. He was determined to take Amy straight home, with just a small side trip to Andalusia during the Age of Chivalry, where, in a small inn on the road to Seville, he had once been served the finest gazpacho he had ever tasted. The doctor was almost completely sure he could find it again.
"We'll go straight home," he said, "after lunch. And over lunch, I'll tell you the story of Maximelos and the three Ogrons."
Diamonds and Pearls, a Fairy Tale. Once upon the olden times, when the trees walked and the stars danced, there was a girl whose mother died, and a new mother came and married her father, bringing her own daughter with her. Soon enough, the father followed his first wife to the grave, leaving his daughter behind him. The new mother did not like the girl and treated her badly, always favoring her own daughter, who was indolent and rude. One day her stepmother gave the girl, who was only 18, $20 to buy her drugs.
"Don't stop on the way," she said.
So the girl took the $20 bill and put an apple into her purse, for the way was long, and she walked out of the house and down to the end of the street where the wrong side of town began. She saw a dog tied to a lamppost, panting and uncomfortable in the heat, and the girl said,
"Poor thing."
She gave it water. The elevator was out of service. The elevator there was always out of service. Halfway up the stairs, she saw a hooker with a swollen face who stared up at her with yellow eyes.
"Here," said the girl.
She gave the hooker the apple. She went up to the dealer's floor, and she knocked on the door three times. The dealer opened the door and stared at her and said nothing. She showed him the $20 bill. Then she said,
"Look at the state of this place."
And she bustled in.
"Don't you ever clean up in here? Where are your cleaning supplies?"
The dealer shrugged. Then he pointed to a closet. The girl opened it and found a broom and a rag. She filled the bathroom sink with water, and she began to clean the place. When the rooms were cleaner, the girl said,
"Give me the stuff for my mother."
He went into the bedroom, came back with a plastic bag. The girl pocketed the bag and walked down the stairs.
"Lady," said the hooker, "the apple was good, but I'm hurting real bad. You got anything?"
The girl said, "It's for my mother."
"Please?" "You poor thing."
The girl hesitated. Then she gave her the packet.
"I'm sure my stepmother will understand," she said.
She left the building. As she passed, the dog said,
"You shine like a diamond, girl."
She got home. Her mother was waiting in the front room.
"Where is it?"
she demanded.
"I'm sorry,"
said the girl. Diamonds dropped from her lips, rattled across the floor. Her stepmother hit her.
"Ow!"
said the girl, a ruby-red cry of pain, and a ruby fell from her mouth. Her stepmother fell to her knees, picked up the jewels.
"Pretty," she said. "Did you steal them?"
The girl shook her head, scared to speak.
"Do you have any more in there?"
The girl shook her head, mouth tightly closed. The stepmother took the girl's tender arm between her finger and her thumb and pinched as hard as she could, squeezed until the tears glistened in the girl's eyes, but she said nothing. So her stepmother locked the girl in her windowless bedroom, so she could not get away. The woman took the diamonds and the ruby to Al's Pawn and Gun on the corner, where Al gave her $500 no questions asked. Then she sent her other daughter off to buy drugs for her. The girl was selfish. She saw the dog panting in the sun, and once she was certain that it was chained up and could not follow, she kicked at it. She pushed past the hooker on the stair. She reached the dealer's apartment and knocked on the door. He looked at her, and she handed him the 20 without speaking. On her way back down, the hooker on the stair said, "Please?" But the girl did not even slow. "Bitch!" called the hooker.
"Snake,"
said the dog, when she passed it on the sidewalk. Back home, the girl took out the drugs, then opened her mouth to say, "Here," to her mother. A small frog, brightly colored, slipped from her lips. It leapt from her arm to the wall where it hung and stared at them, unblinking. "Oh, my God," said the girl. "That's just disgusting." Five more colored tree frogs and one small red black and yellow banded snake. "Black against red," said the girl. "Is that poisonous?" Three more tree frogs, a cane toad, a small blind white snake, and a baby iguana. She backed away from them. Her mother, who was not afraid of snakes or of anything, kicked at the banded snake, which bit her leg. The woman screamed and flailed, and her daughter also began to scream, a long, loud scream which fell from her lips as a healthy adult python. The girl, the first girl, whose name was Amanda, heard the screams and then the silence, but she could do nothing to find out what was happening. She knocked on the door. No one opened it. No one said anything. The only sounds she could hear were rustlings, as if of something huge and legless slipping across the carpet. When Amanda got hungry, too hungry for words, she began to speak. "Thou still unravished bride of quietness," she began, "thou foster child of silence and slow time." She spoke, although the words were choking her. "Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know." A final sapphire clicked across the wooden floor of Amanda's closet room. The silence was absolute. The Return of the Thin White Duke. He was the monarch of all he surveyed, even when he stood out on the palace balcony at night listening to reports and he glanced up into the sky at the bitter twinkling clusters and walls of stars. He ruled the worlds. He had tried for so long to rule wisely and well and to be a good monarch, but it is hard to rule, and wisdom can be painful. And it is impossible, he had found, if you rule, to do only good. You cannot build anything without tearing something down, and even he could not care about every life, every dream, every population of every world. Bit by bit, moment by moment, death by little death, he ceased to care. He would not die, for only inferior people died, and he was the inferior of no one. Time passed. One day, in the deep dungeons, a man with blood on his face looked at the Duke and told him he had become a monster. The next moment, the man was no more, a footnote in a history book. The Duke gave this conversation much thought over the next several days, and eventually he nodded his head. "The traitor was right," he said. "I have become a monster. Ah, well, I wonder if any of us set out to be monsters." Once, long ago, there had been lovers, but that had been in the dawn days of the dukedom. Now, in the dusk of the world, with all pleasures available freely, but what we attain with no effort we cannot value, and with no need to deal with any issues of succession, for even the notion that another would one day succeed the Duke bordered upon blasphemy. There were no more lovers, just as there were no challenges. He felt as if he were asleep, while his eyes were open and his lips spoke, but there was nothing to wake him. The day after it had occurred to the Duke that he was now a monster was the day of strange blossoms, celebrated by the wearing of flowers brought to the ducal palace from every world and every plain. It was the day that all in the ducal palace, which covered a continent, were traditionally merry, and in which they cast off their cares and darknesses. But the Duke was not happy. "How can you be made happy?" asked the information beetle, on his shoulder, there to relay his master's whims and desires to 100 worlds. "Give the word, your grace, and empires will rise and fall to make you smile. Stars will flame novae for your entertainment." "Perhaps I need a heart," said the Duke. "I shall have 100 hearts immediately plucked, ripped, torn, incised, sliced, and otherwise removed from the chests of 10,000 perfect specimens of humanity," said the information beetle. "How do you wish them prepared? Shall I alert the chefs or the taxidermists, the surgeons or the sculptors?" "I need to care about something," said the Duke. "I need to value life. I need to wake." The beetle chittered and chirruped on his shoulder. It could access the wisdom of 10,000 worlds, but it could not advise its master when he was in this mood. So it said nothing. It relayed its concern to its predecessors, the older information beetles and scarabs now sleeping in ornate boxes on 100 worlds, and the scarabs consulted among themselves with regret. Because, in the vastness of time, even this had happened before, and they were prepared to deal with it. A long-forgotten subroutine from the morning of the worlds was set into motion. The Duke was performing the final ritual of the day of strange blossoms with no expression on his thin face, a man seeing his world as it was and valuing it not at all, when a small winged creature fluttered out from the blossom in which she had been hiding.
"Your Grace," she whispered. "My mistress needs you. Please, you are her only hope."
"Your mistress?" asked the Duke. "The creature comes from beyond," clicked the beetle on his shoulder. "From one of the places that does not acknowledge the ducal overlordship, from the lands beyond life and death, between being and unbeing. It must have hidden itself inside an imported off-world orchid blossom. Its words are a trap or a snare. I shall have it destroyed." "No," said the Duke. "Let it be." He did something he had not done for many years, and stroked the beetle with a thin white finger. Its green eyes turned black, and it chittered into perfect silence. He cupped the tiny thing in his hands and walked back to his quarters, while she told him of her wise and noble queen, and of the giants, each more beautiful than the last, and each more huge and dangerous and more monstrous, who kept her queen a captive. And as she spoke, the Duke remembered the days when a lad from the stars had come to world to seek his fortune, for in those days there were fortunes everywhere, just waiting to be found. And in remembering, he discovered that his youth was less distant than he had thought. His information beetle lay quiescent upon his shoulder. "Why did she send you to me?" he asked the little creature. But, her task accomplished, she would speak no more, and in moments she vanished as instantly and as permanently as a star that had been extinguished upon ducal order. He entered his private quarters and placed the deactivated information beetle in its case beside his bed. In his study, he had his servants bring him a long black case. He opened it himself, and with a touch he activated his master advisor. It shook itself, then wriggled up and about his shoulders in viper form, its serpent tail forking into the neural plug at the base of his neck. the Duke told the serpent what he intended to do.
"This is not wise," said the Master Advisor, the intelligence and advice of every ducal advisor in memory available to it, after a moment's examination of precedent.
"I seek adventure, not wisdom," said the Duke. A ghost of a smile began to play at the edges of his lips, the first smile that his servants had seen, in longer than they could remember.
"Then, if you will not be dissuaded, take a battle steed," said the advisor.
It was good advice. The Duke deactivated his master advisor, and he sent for the key to the battle steed's stable. The key had not been played in 1,000 years. Its strings were dusty. There had once been 6 battle steeds, one for each of the lords and ladies of the evening. They were brilliant, beautiful, unstoppable, and when the Duke had been forced, with regret, to terminate the career of each of the rulers of the evening, he had declined to destroy their battle steeds, instead placing them where they could be of no danger to the worlds. The Duke took the key and played an opening arpeggio. The gate opened, and an ink-black, jet-black, coal-black battle steed strutted out with feline grace. It raised its head and stared at the world with proud eyes.
"Where do we go?" asked the battle steed. "What do we fight?"
"We go beyond," said the Duke.
"And as to whom we shall fight, well, that remains to be seen." "I can take you anywhere," said the battle steed, "and I will kill those who try to hurt you."
The Duke clambered onto the battle steed's back, the cold metal yielding as live flesh between his thighs, and he urged it forward. A leap, and it was racing through the froth and flux of underspace. Together they were tumbling through the madness between the worlds. The Duke laughed then, when no man could hear him, as they travelled together through underspace, travelling forever in the undertime that is not reckoned against the seconds of a person's life.
"This feels like a trap of some kind," said the battle steed, as the space beneath galaxies evaporated about them.
"Yes," said the Duke. "I'm sure that it is."
"I have heard of this queen," said the battle steed, "or of something like her. She lives between life and death, and calls warriors and heroes and poets and dreamers to their doom."
"That sounds right," said the Duke.
"And when we return to real space, I would expect an ambush," said the battle steed.
"That sounds more than probable," said the Duke, as they reached their destination and erupted out of underspace back into existence. The guardians of the palace were as beautiful as the messenger had warned him, and as ferocious, and they were waiting.
"What are you doing?" they called as they came in for the assault. "Do you know that strangers are forbidden here? Stay with us. Let us love you. We will devour you with our love."
"I have come to rescue your queen," he told them.
"Rescue the queen?"
They laughed.
"She will have your head on a plate before she looks at you. Many people have come to save her over the years. Their heads sit on golden plates in her palace. Yours will simply be the freshest."
There were men who looked like fallen angels, and women who looked like demons risen. There were people so beautiful that they would have been all that the Duke had ever desired, had they been human. And they pressed close to him, skin to carapace and flesh against armor, so they could feel the coldness of him, and he could feel the warmth of them.
"Stay with us.
Let us love you,"
they whispered, and they reached out with sharp talons and teeth.
"I do not believe your love will prove to be good for me," said the Duke.
One of the women, fair of hair, with eyes of a peculiar translucent blue, reminded him of someone long forgotten, of a lover who had passed out of his life a long time before. He found her name in his mind, and would have called it aloud to see if she turned, to see if she knew him, but the battle steed lashed out with sharp claws, and the pale blue eyes were closed forever. The battle steed moved fast, like a panther, and each of the guardians fell to the ground and writhed, and was still. The Duke stood before the Queen's palace. He slipped from his battle steed to the fresh earth. "Here I go on alone," he said. "Wait, and one day I shall return." "I do not believe you will ever return," said the battle steed. "I shall wait until time itself is done, if need be. But still, I fear for you." The Duke touched his lips to the black steel of the steed's head and bade it farewell. He walked on to rescue the Queen. He remembered a monster who had ruled worlds and who would never die, and he smiled because he was no longer that man. For the first time since his first youth, he had something to lose, and the discovery of that made him young again. His heart began to pound in his chest as he walked through the empty palace, and he laughed out loud. She was waiting for him in the place where flowers die. She was everything he had imagined that she would be. Her skirt was simple and white, her cheekbones were high and very dark, her hair was long, and the infinitely dark color of a crow's wing. "I am here to rescue you," he told her. "You are here to rescue yourself," she corrected him. Her voice was almost a whisper, like the breeze that shook the dead blossoms. He bowed his head, although she was as tall as he was. "Three questions," she whispered. "Answer them correctly, and all you desire shall be yours. Fail, and your head will rest forever on a golden dish." Her skin was the brown of the dead rose petals. Her eyes were the dark gold of amber. "Ask your three questions," he said, with a confidence he did not feel. The Queen reached out a finger, and she ran the tip of it gently along his cheek. The Duke could not remember the last time that anybody had touched him without his permission. "What is bigger than the universe?" she asked.
"Under space and under time," said the Duke, "for they both include the universe and also all that is not the universe. But I suspect you seek a more poetic, less accurate answer. The mind, then, for it can hold a universe, but also imagine things that have never been and are not." The Queen said nothing.
"Is that right? Is that wrong?" asked the Duke. He wished, momentarily, for the snake-like whisper of his master advisor, unloading through its neural plug the accumulated wisdom of his advisors over the years, or even the chitter of his information beetle.
"The second question," said the Queen. "What is greater than a king?"
"Obviously a duke," said the Duke, "for all kings, popes, chancellors, empresses, and such serve at and only at my will. But again, I suspect that you are looking for an answer that is less accurate and more imaginative. The mind, again, is greater than a king or a duke, because although I am the inferior of nobody, there are those who could imagine a world in which there is something superior to me and something else again superior to that, and so on." "No, wait, I have the answer. It is from the great tree, Kether, the crown. The concept of monarchy is greater than any king." The Queen looked at the Duke with amber eyes, and she said, "The final question for you. What can you never take back?"
"My word," said the Duke. "Although now I come to think of it, once I give my word, sometimes circumstances change, and sometimes the worlds themselves change in unfortunate or unexpected ways. From time to time, if it comes to that, my word needs to be modified in accordance with realities. I would say death, but truly if I find myself in need of someone I have previously disposed of, I simply have them reincorporated."
The Queen looked impatient. "A kiss," said the Duke. She nodded.
"There is hope for you," said the Queen. "You believe you are my only hope, but truthfully, I am yours. Your answers were all quite wrong, but the last was not as wrong as the rest of them."
The Duke contemplated losing his head to this woman, and found the prospect less disturbing than he would have expected. A wind blew through the garden of dead flowers, and the Duke was put in mind of perfumed ghosts. "Would you like to know the answer?" she asked. "Answers," he said, "surely." "Only one answer, and it is this.